Sally Quinn is a longtime Washington Post journalist, columnist, television commentator, and one of the Capitol's renowned social hostesses and founder of the religious website On Faith from the Washington Post. In her new book, Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir, we learn about her adventures as a journalist, covering the Shah of Iran during the last days of his reign. She takes us through her career at the Washington Post, her short tenure as the first female anchor on the CBS Morning News, and falling in love with the Washington Post's executive editor, Ben Bradley. Again, the name of the book is Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Sally Quinn to the roundtable this morning. Sally, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, I'm so happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you. So that title of a spiritual memoir actually has double meaning, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, part of it started out with my website On Faith, which I started for the Washington Post, and I was an atheist at the time that I started the website 11 years ago, and I was asked to do a book for Harper One about an atheist starting a religion website because it became really successful, and nobody, including my very own husband, could believe that I was doing a religion website. And so that's what it was about. And so there was this whole spiritual journey aspect of it, because what happened in the end was that I ended up not being an atheist after I started the website and studying about religion and learning about it and taking a trip around the world to study the great faiths. But it also is about spirituality in my own life and what I realized mattered and what religion to me was, that I came to the conclusion after writing this book that all religion is magic and that we're all spiritual. Even the most diehard atheists are really spiritual, only they just don't know it. And that there's magic out there for all of us to find if we're only looking for it. And one of the things I quote, and there's a wonderful quote where it says that children find magic because they look for it, you know. And I think that a lot of us are too grown up to look for magic in our lives. And it's right there in front of us.
You talk about your childhood. You grew up in the Deep South and surrounded by the occult. There was a lot of voodoo and tarot cards and Ouija boards and the like. That's what you grew up with.
Yeah, well, I was a good Presbyterian. My aunt, we were all Scottish Presbyterians. I'm from Savannah, Georgia, and we spent our summers in Statesboro, a little town outside of Savannah, in this great, big, huge antebellum, white-columned house, and my Aunt Ruth played the organ in the Presbyterian church. But she also had this other religion, which the whole family did, which is the sort of Scottish mysticism. And they all believed in the Scottish stones and the time travel and astrology and ghosts and voodoo and palmistry and tarot and all kinds of the Ouija board. And I grew up believing all of that. And that was what I call my embedded religion, where ghosts are part of your life and the mysterious, you know, and both my Aunt Ruth and her sister, my grandmother, my mother, her sister, my sister and I all have psychic abilities. They were really psychic, but I have certain psychic abilities, and so I've lived with that all of my life, and knowing things, not always, but knowing when things are going to happen before they happen, that sort of thing. And I used to be embarrassed about it, and a lot of my friends would tease me and call me witchy, and you know, but they all knew this about me, this part of me, because I've been going to an astrologers for years, and actually the same astrologer for 40 years, who I think is fantastic and brilliant. And so everybody sort of said, oh, well, that's Sally. But I came to realize that because this was never considered legitimate in comparison to other sort of organized religions like Catholicism or Judaism or Hinduism or Buddhism, but that in fact the mysterious and the mystery is always there in every religion, and mysticism. Every religion has this, and that what these things that people believed were no different, and so they were just as legitimate as an organized religion. And so, you know, some of these things that I have been debunked and in my own mind, and other things I still believe. And you know, I think everybody has I mean, the famous atheist Christopher Hitchens said he always reads his horoscope in the newspaper every day. And he died a few years ago. And he said if he found a penny, he would always keep it because he thought it was good luck. And Richard Dawkins, who is one of the great atheists, said that he never wanted to step on a crack because he was afraid he'd break his mother's back. And said he would never spend the night in a haunted house because he'd be too scared. I mean, I think, you know, we all have these little things, that these superstitions that we carry around. I mean, if you look at football players on Sunday, you know, I mean, where you people wearing crosses or people cross themselves. And a friend of mine always puts a statue of the Virgin Mary down her front when she travels on the highway for safety. And people wear St. Christopher medals, and in the Middle East, you know, everybody wears evil eyes, and people have... My father, when he was in the military, he was fighting in Korea, and he was nicknamed Buffalo Bill, and his regiment was the Buffaloes, and he sent away for Buffalo nickels and gave everybody in the regiment a Buffalo nickel and said, you have to carry this for good luck for the rest of your life. And today, I mean, and the idea was that if you met a Buffalo, you would always demand to see their nickel. Even today, there are still Buffaloes. And somebody will come up and say, now they're all in their 80s, I'm a Buffalo, and I'd say, let me see your nickel. And they would produce a nickel, and I wear one around my neck for good luck. So I think that all of this stuff, I mean, we all have these little superstitions and this idea that there's some protection up there, some mystery. And, you know, that extends to prayer as well, that people pray. Now, we don't know. People pray to a god, some god that they believe in. And my feeling is that whatever people want to believe in, that's fine with me as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. But I think it's all magic.
So as you moved away from atheism, you found a way to incorporate the mystical into your beliefs.
Yeah, and, you know, I was very sick in Japan, and was in the hospital for 9 months when my father was in Korea. And I was an atheist because my father went to Germany, and he, fighting in World War II, he liberated Dachau and took pictures of the concentration camp, all these bodies. And I found a scrapbook of these horrible pictures. And he explained to me what happened, and I said, did God know about this? And he said, yes. And I said, well, how could he have let this happen? And he said, well, you know, God works in mysterious ways. I was 4 years old at the time. I was completely devastated, but all I could think about were these little Jewish children and their parents in the concentration camps praying to the same God I was praying to for protection of my family, and look what happened to them. So I stopped believing in God. And then, you know, and then in Japan, when I was in the hospital, they were bringing all these soldiers in from Korea, these young kids, you know, with no arms and legs and burns and, you know, dying on stretchers in front of me. And again, I kept thinking, how could God have allowed this? But as I got older, and I had a son 35 years ago who was born with a hole in his heart, and he had heart surgery, and he was severely learning disabled and many other medical problems. And I went through all of that with him and then watched both my parents die. My mother was a stroke victim, and I took care of her. I took care of my son, and then my father died, and then my husband got dementia, Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post. And right. I took care of him for the last couple of years of his life. And during that time, I began to realize that what was really a horrible time in my life was really the most spiritual time that I had ever spent. And it was kind of a shocking revelation to me that I could find solace in taking care of this person I love so much. And it was really, in some way, the happiest 2 years of my life taking care of Ben. And he died 3 years ago last weekend. And so that gave me a sense of understanding of what my life was meaning, what gave my life meaning. And, you know, I think we all search for meaning in our lives, and we all look for the transcendent and some way to be in touch with the divine, and that was it for me. And I, you know, toward the end of the book, I, I realized that I had to sort of come up with some idea of what gave my life meaning, and I was on deadline. And I sort of thought, oh, my God, I've got 2 months to figure out the meaning of life. But I did, for me. And that may not, I mean, this is not a self-help book in any way. It's a series of stories in my life in which every single story that I chose to write about had some sort of epiphany or some illumination or some awakening of or some idea of transcendence that happened to me that was meaningful, that led like little breadcrumbs all the way through the forest up the path to where I came out, which is that what gave meaning to my life and what made me the happiest was taking care of the people I loved. And that was a revelation to me because, you know, I've always cared so much about my career and my writing, and yet I'd had to give it up for many years, pretty much 16 years while I was taking care of Quinn when he was in and out of the hospital, and then the last 2 years of Ben's life where I didn't work at all. But I wasn't resentful. I wasn't bitter. I might have been a little wistful, but this was in an odd way it was a gift for me. And Ben was in this study at Harvard. It was called the Grant Study, and they did this. They started with his group at Harvard. They did 4 classes at Harvard, and Jack Kennedy was also in the study. And they followed them all the way through their lives. And they every year they would write out these questionnaires, and they all did it religiously about their, you know, their families, their relationships, their children, their jobs, their health. And this guy who did the study, George Valiant, wrote a book about it. And in the end, he said, I have come to one conclusion, that there is only one way to happiness, and that is love, full stop. And it was such a gigantic light bulb that went over in my head, because I thought, that's it. That's why I was so happy taking care of Ben, because Ben was this really macho, tough guy, you know, and didn't like to be dependent on anybody and didn't like to be weak, couldn't stand that. And yet in the last 2 years, he became dependent on me, and he sort of let it go. He allowed himself to be dependent on me and let me take care of him. And that made me so happy that I didn't have to fight him all the time to be able to help him and take care of him. And it was a wonderful period in our lives. And it was all because we were able to love each other and totally. And for me, that was magic.
You write about this in the book about the beginning of your relationship, and you would write Ben anonymous love notes. And this was in the middle, and I couldn't believe this. This was the middle of Watergate, which seems like a dangerous time to begin an affair, but there you are.
Yeah. Well, we had been accidentally seated next to each other on a flight down to Miami to cover the convention in August. And the travel office just put us in the seats next to each other. And it was a very turbulent flight, and I kept grabbing onto it. I'm not a good flyer. But in any case, I fell madly in love with him in those 2 hours. I'd been working for the Post for 4 years and calling him at that point Mr. Bradley. And we tried to get together a couple of times. He later admitted that he had fallen in love with me during that time. And so we would have these little flirtatious moments in the newsroom. And then I would write these little notes, anonymous notes, and that I would say, you know, but just in reference to something that we had discussed in these little encounters. And he never got it. He had no idea who was sending me notes. I mean, men can be so stupid sometimes. Sorry, I don't want to offend you.
No, I understand. I think you're deadly accurate in that.
And, you know, so later, and I went to this friend and I said, you know, I'm in love with him. We're right in the middle of Watergate. And he said, you cannot tell him, because if he takes you up on it, you could destroy the story, you could destroy the paper, you could destroy the country. You've got to put your country first. And, of course, talking to an Army brat, that was the one thing he said that could make a difference. So I didn't approach Ben. Instead, I accepted a job in New York. I had a boyfriend in New York, and I accepted a job in New York to be the first network anchor woman in America on the CBS Morning News, and quit the paper in May because I just couldn't stand to be around Ben any longer. And So I took him, I asked him to take me to a farewell lunch, and I told him that I was leaving because I was in love with him. And he said, I can't believe you're telling me this because I've been in love with you for the last year. And I said, at some point, it was revealed that I was the sender of the notes, and he was just stunned. But I was starting the TV show, so we couldn't do anything. So we were sort of sneaking around and hiding. But what he did do is he moved out of his house, and right away, because he realized that, you know, if we were going to have this, that he didn't want to be blackmailed. I mean, the thing was that the Nixon people thought they were wiretapping his house and having him followed and his phones, and Woodward and Bernstein, the same thing. I mean, they just had to be very careful. So he just decided that he would leave and moved into a hotel. And then we didn't want the publicity while I was, you know, launching this TV show. So it wasn't until September, late September, that we sort of came out of the closet about our relationship. But when he wrote his book, A Good Life, which, by the way, is being re-released in another week or so, by Simon and Schuster. It's got a new foreword by Woodward and Bernstein and an afterword by me. But when he wrote his book, he put in that I'd sent him these anonymous notes. And I took the manuscript and crossed them out in red letters, you know, red pen, you know, no way, I don't want this, it's embarrassing. And then he put them back in again, unbeknownst to me, so they were in his book. So I figured, well, he'd already revealed it, so that I went ahead and put it in my book, too.
You do say that he still appears to you.
Always. Hmm. Yes. Well, I had a ceremony the year to mark the year after his death. The Jews call it Jahrzeit, which is German for year's time. And I had a mausoleum built for our family, and I moved Ben's casket from the chapel at the cemetery into the mausoleum. And about a week before that, I had read this article by this woman whose husband, she was a journalist whose husband had been the editor of the New York Observer, and he had died of cancer. And two friends who'd also lost people they loved called her and said, you've got to go to this medium. And so she called the medium, and the medium started telling her things that Peter, her husband, was saying to her. The medium was saying, I'm talking to Peter, and he's saying this. And he was telling her all these things that no one but she and Peter could know, conversations they'd had, nicknames for each other, this kind of thing. That's out of the blue. And so she spent a year interviewing this woman and talking to her and writing about it, because she was a complete, I mean, she'd never been to an astrologer. She'd never had a psychic moment. She was a total skeptic. But she was completely blown away by this medium. When I read this, I called the medium, and she started telling me things that Ben was saying to her. I talked to her twice, I think, maybe three times. And the things she told me were extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary, and no way anybody could ever have known what she told me, except from Ben and me. And I was taking notes on it, and I called the woman Lisa who had written the piece about her husband, and she said, all I can tell you is I don't believe any of this, but I believe this woman because I believe that she was talking to Peter. And so I did have these conversations, but it was so odd. I kept putting it off because I don't know how to describe it. I was ecstatic on the one hand that I was getting these messages from Ben, but on the other hand, it made me really sad because he wasn't there, and I was crying the whole time I was talking to her. And finally, I just decided I didn't want to talk to her anymore. It was too painful to have Ben there and not have him there. And I don't know what to say about it. I don't know whether I believe this or not, but all I can tell you is that it was an extraordinary experience.
So your initial answer to the question was that he still is very much with you every day. So even though
I talk to him every day.
Yeah. So even though you don't have that experience, there still is the conversation, and still is the feeling, his presence is still
there
for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I ask him for advice, and, you know, at the end, you know, most cultures, they consider that the 3 years is the end of the mourning period, and that was last weekend for me. And I went up to the mausoleum and spent some time with Ben. And I basically, you know, thanked him for helping me get through this horrible time in my life. And you know, just ask him to help me keep doing the right thing and making the right decisions. And I just feel like in some way he's guiding me and my son Quinn, and he's looking out after me. And that, who knows whether he is or not, but just thinking that gives me enormous comfort and enormous solace.
The name of the book is Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir. It is published by Harper One. Sally Quinn, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
And thank you for your good questions.
Thank you very much. Be
okay.
Well.
Bye.
Again, the name of the book is Finding Magic, a Spiritual Memoir by Sally Quinn. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.